are here for now our third and final oral argument this morning, which is case number A22-1843, Christy Coleman et al. Respondents versus Joseph M. Garding et al. Appellants. Counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. At the start of your principal arguments, please state your name and the parties you represent for the record. The center podium toggles up and down. It's pretty high right now. I think we must have had a tall last arguer, so it toggles down if you need it. And we are ready for you, counsel for appellant, when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah, you might want to drop that a little bit.
Sure.
Or even the whole podium. Do you see the toggle switch?
Oh.
Then we can see you a little bit better, too. Down below. Yep. There you go. And you can maybe see your notes better, too.
Thank you.
Yep. Great. And then tip your mic up a little bit, and then we should be good to go. Great. Thanks.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, I would like to reserve time for rebuttal, as mentioned.
Yep, you'll have 5 minutes, whether you reserve it or not. Yep.
My name is Sarah Jewell, J-E-W-E-L-L. I represent the appellants in this matter, Joseph Garding, Janice Garding, and Garding Farms, LLC. We submitted, and I apologize, a pretty lengthy brief. We were pushing the limits on the briefing just because of the complex nature of the issues we feel needed to be presented. Otherwise, we know that they would be waived, and so we felt the need. But I apologize, I know that's a lot of reading. And so without regurgitating all of that, I'm trying to hit just the high points here to allow for questions, as I'm sure there may be some.
So let's
yes.
get right to the questions
yes,
then.
Sure.
So you are contesting the grant of summary judgment and then also what happened at trial.
Correct.
So I have two questions. The first one relates to summary judgment. The judge went through the undisputed facts when the judge entered the summary judgment order. Are you contesting that any of those are disputed facts?
Thank you for raising that. I do feel there was a couple of briefing errors in our brief, and because it makes it sound like we are disputing facts, we actually had competing summary judgment motions. And so what we're seeking from the appellate court is actually summary judgment in favor of appellants.
Okay, but I'm looking at the judge's summary judgment order, and if you go to page 3 of 9, it starts at middle, goes through 4, and then partway through 5, and just the judge says these are the undisputed material facts.
Okay.
And then lists the disputed facts after that. And I didn't see in your briefing that you're saying the judge is wrong on those undisputed facts.
Correct.
That's right? Okay.
Yes.
So then my second question goes to the trial and the findings of fact. It was a court trial.
Yes.
And so because your clients didn't file a motion for new trial, I am wondering what you think is here in front of us on appeal. What issues do you think we can look at based on the fact that no new trial motion was filed?
And thank you for that question. That to me goes with the first appeal that was filed in this case because the judge did bifurcate the issues. So the first portion of the case, we had the summary judgment competing motions that went in the way of the respondents. He did make it a final certified order as a partial order, which we had to immediately appeal, but pursuant to Contractor's Edge, that got remanded back. And so after the trial, that was when we felt we could do the appeal based on all of the issues together. And I guess my view of those issues is that they are very much intertwined in terms of, the transactions were all signed on the same date, the contract for deed, purchase agreement, and the lease. So as far as those trial issues, that goes to the gifting portion, which we're talking about as well in our brief today.
The $30,000?
Correct, the $30,000 of the gifting. We're not, disputing anything else in regards to that. It was pretty much bifurcated to just that $30,000 and where that gets allocated and how that was
and
treated.
Then there were the attorney's fees.
Yes, that is in dispute.
So my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is that it was your client's attorney who drafted the lease. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. Yes, it is correct. although I would like to just clarify one thing on that, too. So that was before I was involved in the matter, but that one attorney did draft all the documents, and she was the only attorney involved in the transactions. So the Colemans did not have their own separate attorney. And so, you know, we know from Ms. Springer's testimony at trial that she was working with the Colemans. They called him an accountant, but he's actually just a tax preparer, an IRS tax preparer. They worked with him to get the numbers for the deal. So she drafted the documents, and then emails went back and forth, which were introduced at trial, that indicated she was leaving all the numbers for the deals blank.
So that the parties... Can I ask you about that? Because I saw you say it's a tax preparer,
Middendorf. Yes.
Middendorf. Sometimes he's referred to as being the Coleman's tax preparer, and sometimes both of theirs. I mean, I understand that your clients later switched and got a new tax person or accountant, however you want to refer to it. But at the time of initial transaction together, was Mr. Middendorf both of the parties' tax preparer?
And thank you, Your Honor, for that question. So the testimony that went forward in depositions in the case were that in years past, my clients had utilized Mr. Middendorf's services. Mm-hmm. They didn't like something with those services, stopped using his services, went to Schlenner Wenner Company in St. Cloud, which is a larger CPA firm in that area, and started using the services of Aaron Smith.
And I'm just asking, was that after the three key documents here were put together?
Actually, it was before that, but the Colemans essentially told the Guardians, if you want to make this deal with us, you have to use our gentleman, Mr. Middendorf. And they did agree to do that for this transaction only. I hope that answered the question. May I move on at this time?
Please.
Okay, thank you. So I would also like to highlight in terms of our briefing that neither of the parties argued or even claimed that the terms of the party's contract for deed were ambiguous or vague. Both parties at summary judgment said, nope, the terms are clear, and asked the judge to make a ruling based on those clear and unambiguous terms as argued by each side. Obviously, we don't agree the outcome of that. But so I want to make this argument that, you know, it was an error then for the district court to have considered parallel evidence outside the four corners of those documents in order to make the determinations that were made at summary judgment. And that there's quite a lot of parallel evidence that was considered by the court. The homemade amortization charts that were made by Ms. Coleman, one of the respondents, they were never incorporated or integrated into the contract for deed. They were not attached to the contract for deed at the time of closing. Ms. Springer, the attorney, former attorney for my clients, told me she did not create or make those. Mr. Middendorf testified at the second part of the case at trial that he had made some of those in connection with Christy Coleman, but those were never incorporated into the contract. Those are outside the four corners of the documents. Also, several alleged oral agreements related to payment terms, timing of payments, cutting down of live green trees, which was one of those consent clauses that my clients added to paragraph 20 of the contract.
But then there's that settlement agreement.
Yes, and I agree with you. So there was a settlement agreement. I don't dispute that, although we do dispute that it was never labeled a settlement agreement. It was kind of a letter, but perhaps functioned as one at the moment. It was a letter from Ms. Springer to the Colemans telling them.
Document I'm looking at says agreement and has a map.
Oh yes,
attached to it. That's what I'm talking about.
Okay, thank you for clarifying. That the parties made with their kids the night that this whole thing blew up regarding the tree cutting and the loggers coming in. So, I would say yes, they did do an informal kind of a sit down at the coffee table and draft something out. What my clients testified to in their depositions was that after even that agreement was made with the map, that the loggers even then violated that agreement. So there was yet a breach even of that agreement, that they cut down even more trees in their front yard and other areas that they had specifically said not to go into. And so that was also raised before the district court, but was pretty much dismissed. The other oral agreements that I would like to mention are supposed oral agreements regarding how much tiling work could be done, My clients had no idea that the Colemans were ordering over $50,000 worth of new tile lines to be installed on the farm. And we did obtain information from the Colemans in their deposition that the Geisy Excavating Company, which is the company who had done work on this farm in the past with the Gardings, that they refused to give them a quote. They did not provide a written quote or a number. I think the notion there was, well, we need to kind of see how many roots are in the lines and let you know. But what was never spoken about was adding extensive new tile lines to the farm that my clients did not know about, nor did they agree to ever in writing. And so these are all alleged oral agreements that are, again, outside the four corners of the document, and there is no document saying, and the Geisys as well did not provide any document that said this will stay within $5,000 or we'll come and talk to you about it and have a written agreement made so that we can then see if that's something that, you know, we are okay with encumbering the property. You know, obviously those clauses are there to avoid the potential for a mechanic's lien if it was disputed and went unpaid. I know that later those bills were paid in large part by the Gardings. They did that to avoid the fact of a potential mechanic's lien and just the family dynamics and things like that. But they never waived that clause in the contract for deed, and they certainly weren't happy about it. And the other oral agreement that is a parallel evidence matter is the payment application of the proceeds of that sale of tractor and baler. It seems the Colemans respondents wanted that to be taken totally off the principal with no allocation at all for 3.5% interest. That is a great deal if you can get it. And, you know, my clients did not agree to that. That was not ever something that they said, yep, we're willing to forego the 3.5% interest. And so we also have a clause in our contract for deed that states, you know, the failure to seek a remedy at the time something happens is not a waiver thereof. So we did, you know, my clients did not waive that, no matter how much the Colemans want to assert in their favor that they did. That's just not present in the case.
Ms. Jules, you're giving us a lot of facts.
Sure.
And it seems to me that you don't agree with the facts. You're giving us other ones that would support your arguments. Could you give us, but we don't, generally we're very hesitant to overturn facts unless they're clearly not supported by the record. So tell me, what's your best legal argument about why we should reverse here?
Yeah, so the legal argument is that this case is very similar to the Woodard case, which is cited. I know it's an unpublished case by this court. And it basically says that just because you're family members or you have this close familial relationship, that does not on its own allow parties to presume that there is, you know, agreement to things that are, you know, or waiver to certain things that are in the contract. And I think that's a really strong on-point case. In that case, of course, there was only one breach, which is the anti-transfer clause related to the TOD that was done. Here, we believe there are multiple breaches, and that's our strongest legal argument for you, I believe.
So I think I want to make sure that I really understand what you're asking for, right, as a disposition from us. I think that you said at the start that we should reverse and direct the entry of summary judgment for your clients. And which is not what you have in your conclusion. You ask for that, and then you say, in the alternative, new trial. Right. And then when we went over the summary judgment motion, which really addresses what you're arguing about here, right? This stuff is decided on summary judgment, the material breaches, et cetera. I'm hearing sort of two things, that maybe there either are some disputed facts you're arguing, or maybe there are undisputed facts that weren't acknowledged by the district court. Is that your point in the summary judgment order?
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes. So we presented, we presented affidavits, declarations, I should say, of different witnesses, some of which were not parties to the transaction. They, one of them is Gail Wheeling, another daughter of the Gardings. She was there the night that this tree dispute blew up and that they tried to hammer out the tree, the original little scratch tree deal. She overheard Jeremy Coleman saying, well, I bleep effed up type thing, with the contract when it came to the cutting of live green trees, admitted he did not read the terms of the contract. We presented that to the district court. He did not address that at all in his decision. And so you are correct. We are primarily asking for reversal and summary judgment in favor of the appellants in this matter. But recognizing that the court really did not address, you know, those disputed facts at the time of summary judgment, we are saying as well in the alternative that should have been a trial issue then. If the court wasn't convinced that summary judgment should have been granted to the appellants in this matter, then the fallback position would have been for a trial in that first part of the case, which we did not get. We got a trial on the $30,000 question at the end.
And can I ask you this? Judge Riley had asked you questions about focusing on a summary judgment order. What undisputed facts do you challenge? And I think that you said you didn't challenge any. When I look at the district court's order on page 6, once it gets in, of 9, once it gets into the legal analysis, the last paragraph on page 6, the carryover paragraph, says, here it is undisputed that the parties entered into a contract to sell slash purchase the land for $523,250. Do you challenge that finding? That the purchase, the contract to sell or purchase was for $523,250.
We do, because that, if you take that is the purchase price, then that's what should have been in the contract for deed and the purchase agreement. And with the declaration we submitted to the court from my client's accountant, Aaron Smith, he said, you know, this is not something that's totally unheard of, structuring a transaction, something like this, but the way that this one was done was not correct. And what he described to me, and, you know, I don't do taxes, but he is good at it. He described it to me as being, okay, if you really wanted to do that, then you would have to write up the contract for deed to actually say we're selling this property for $523,250, period. And
but
that is the sale
price. But
then
you don't get the benefit of the taxes.
Actually, that wasn't what he explained it to me as. What he said is you could still do this tax thing, but it would be a separate, with the gift taxing return, it would be separate. And that's because it's overinflating the sale price, and that hides from the tax authorities what the actual price paid was. So it's not necessarily that you're causing, you know, a tax issue right now, but in the future, the purchaser, which is this case the respondents, would receive a greatly stepped up basis in the property.
And are you referring to trial testimony right now?
Pardon me?
Are you referring to trial testimony right now or affidavit testimony?
No,
when you're
actually.
Okay.
We provided that in a declaration statement.
In a declaration,
yes,
gotcha.
At the summary judgment stage.
Great.
So he explained that because we also were unclear as to how that, you know, why would that be something someone would come up with? Well, you know, the CPA is saying you would have done it where you actually list the price out exactly what it is so everybody understands that is the price. And then separately this $600,000 gifting apart from that to get it close to the actual market value.
Okay. We've taken you a little over your time. You'll have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. May I please the court? I'm Gerald Von Korff, representing the respondents, the Colemans. I had intended to begin by defending the district court's determination that the alleged material, I guess incurable breaches, I think that was the allegation, that they were not material incurable breaches, but I'm left to believe that the counsel has indicated that she's not disagreeing with those facts. And so I don't, I mean, if it would be helpful to go through that, but it seems as though there were really two, putting aside the attorney's fees, two big issues here. One was the judge correct in determining this was a $523,000 transaction with a $110,000 down payment, and a $600,000 gift is one issue. And then the other issue was, well, we can cancel contract anyway because of material breaches, but it seems as though there's been a concession that they're not material breaches, but if it would help for me to walk through that, otherwise it seems to me I should go to the question of that this is a $523,000 contract with a gift.
Are the breaches resolved by, is your argument that they settled it and they were resolved and the district court was not wrong to consider them resolved?
There are multiple problems with the claim there are three issues they raised: the tiling, the trees, and the
insurance.
Failure to make the payments.
There are issues with the insurance too.
So I mean, they all have kind of the same features in common, that they each involve something that the guardians accepted, acquiesced, induced, or agreed was going to be okay, and now later want to remember something else. And then second, that none of these claims were advanced at the time as material cancellation worthy events. So in each case, there's a discussion about it, there's a resolution. They continue to accept payments. They go all the way to the end of the point where the Colemans come and say, "Mom and Dad, we think we'd be all better off if we pay this down. We've gone to the bank and we're gonna pay you off." And now they say, "Back then, we didn't tell you about this, but we hash it out. But now we're claiming, after taking all these payments in between, that you are not only didn't we like what you did, but that's a material brief and in cancellations."
And yeah, what's the obligation to give an opportunity to cure? Where does that derive from?
Well, I think we're a step away from opportunity to cure, because the difference between all of the cases make it clear you don't walk past and they're not a super lot of cases about this, but the Woodard case alludes to this, because the penalty for forfeiture is you lose your equity. All the payments that you have put in, they're all gone, and we get the land back. And so when something happens that you later want to say as a material default, but you keep taking payments, what you're really doing is collecting as much as you can before you declare.
Right. I was just asking because I think you said two things, that they acquiesced in it, and then you sort of said, secondly, they only complained later. So I understand the acquiescence argument and the various alleged breaches, you know, cutting down trees, tiling, et cetera. You're not arguing that if they had done that without, you know, you're not arguing that it couldn't be material, but you're saying it was acquiesced in. And then I thought you had a second argument,
they didn't complain at the time
as if there's an obligation to give.
They make it not material.
Okay.
By not triggering the cancellation. I mean, just by way of example, part three of the brief, their brief, says we can cancel this contract because the Colemans missed the first six payments. Okay. At the end of the six payments, and there's a There's the testimony is from the Colemans. They said we could wait until the bailer sold. But what if there's a misunderstanding? Then they come and in June and they say, Mom and Dad, we're really uncomfortable with not making these payments. Here are six payments and another $106,000.
I'm going to change the focus of your argument a little bit. So I asked Ms. Jewell what the impact of not filing a motion for a new trial was with regard to our scope of appeal. As I understand her argument, she's arguing because the grant of summary judgment and their appeal of that, those issues are so intertwined with trial issues that in essence, I think she's saying we can have a fulsome, it would be de novo review on the summary judgment and that we're not limited in our review of the trial issues in spite of there not being a motion for a new trial. What's your understanding of the scope of our review?
What
would be the summary judgment and the trial?
We did not argue, and I'm wheels are turning to see if I can come up with one, but I don't think there is one. We are not arguing that the scope of review on the matters resolved by summary judgment is different because of the trial. In fact, to be fair, during the trial, there was an attempt to throw some of those issues in, and if you read the transcript, you'll see Mr. Myers saying, no, 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 and the judge saying, no, 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 no. So, if I could come up with an argument, I would, but I don't think the argument is there. They appealed the summary judgment. The court said, nope, you can't. It was, and so I think that they preserved those issues. I just don't think they have merit, respectfully. I mean, we've tried to address them. I don't think they have merit. But I just wanted to finish.
So how do you respond to Ms. Jewell's argument that the contract is unambiguous, the contract for deed? It says that the purchase price is over $1 million, and yet the judge found, in contradiction to that, at summary judgment, that the price was actually $523,000.
Well, the deal is we're going to do this contract for this price, but you, the Gardings, are going to gift this amount. I suppose if they'd signed and sealed all of those papers, putting aside the gift tax return and all those other things that were done, right on that spot and right after that contract, the Gardings had said, oh, we're going to hold you to $1 million. If they'd have said that, we'd have a different case, but that's not what happened here. This was a payment, gift to reduce the amount by gift. And there's over, and by simply just looking at that one document and ignoring all the other documents and saying the documents are unambiguous, we're omitting the other things that happened, which is, the answer from the Gardings Council when this went through.
The first answer, the unamended answer.
The unamended answer, but that's certainly a piece of evidence. Then the Gardings' own testimony, because they repeatedly said, no, 520. They didn't devise the method to get to their price. That was done by accountant and attorney. And the gift was made. It was documented on both sides, gift tax returns were filed, and furthermore, when you look at the contract for deed, the payments agreed to amortize exactly to the agreed price.
Go ahead, Judge Jefferson.
So thinking about the issues coming from summary judgment, so the district court here found that it was undisputed that there was a gift that appellants made of $626,750, right?
Correct.
And so isn't the big picture issue before us about whether the farm purchase agreement, which says the sale is for $1,040,000, is enough to create a disputed fact for purposes of summary judgment? Is that the best way to look at this from a big picture perspective?
It can't because...
Well, I'm just asking if that's... isn't that the issue here?
I'd never thought of it that way. I don't think there's any evidence that this wasn't the deal. We're going to name a price. We're going to immediately gift to you and treat the balance due as 500. You know, this is not evidence, but if you read the information about what's going on in the market, 20% or more of transactions are just like this, where parents or family.
But Ms., you know that we're not interested in information that isn't in the record.
No. I'm saying, it can't be that if parents make a gift. Sometimes they make a gift on Christmas. Sometimes they make a gift on in celebration of an anniversary, that you say because the gift was not in the family mortgage, it can't count because the gift is not the price. It's a payment on the price, and that is uncontested. Nothing from the other side, none of the testimony said, oh, they owe me $600,000 or $700,000, $800,000. They actually, when they canceled the contract, they came up with $720,000, which was an accelerated balance, which...
Right. I mean, they came to that assuming a $1 million sale price.
But they accelerated that balance.
Right. So can I just ask you, and I'm sure this is evident, and it's just my not being certain, but evident from your argument or maybe the record. So when we look at the contract for deed, it states a sale price of $1 million. And then there are monthly payments over 20 years of $2,954.25. And it also assumes in there, I think, that there's essentially like the borrowing rate from them of 3.5%. So if... under this contract, someone had paid at the purchase price of $523. Well, if someone paid $2,954.25 every month, at the end of the day, for 20 years per the contract, are you saying at the end of the day they would have been, that's a purchase price of $523, et cetera, with a 3.5% interest rate?
It is 15 years because the attorney made a mistake. The two of them were talking 15 and 20.
Well, I'm just looking at, it says on January 21, 2019, the first payment, and then January 1, 2039, the last payment.
No, I understand, but okay. The testimony is that one of them wanted 15 and one of them wanted 20. And
Before you talk about testimony, let's look at the face of this contract with respect to what does it unambiguously say. And I want to know if we reverse looked at our amortization schedule and looked at that monthly payment, assumed that interest rate, at the end of 20 years, what would you get to? One point something million or something less?
You would get to zero.
Sorry, what purchase price would that be based on? The one
if
point something million?
If you pretended that there was no gift, the balance would go up.
What would the purchase price be if someone was paying $2,954.25 a month for 20 years, assuming an interest rate of 3.5%?
I don't know, because what it is 15 years. That amortizes to exactly to 400 and some, because remember the down payment. It amortizes exactly 100% to zero in 15 years.
At 15 years, I see. And why should we, so the district court considered, we're way over. The district court considered 15 years because the trial on summary judgment, because the undisputed evidence was 15 years?
The parties testified that there was going to be a gift, and there was.
Okay, so you're saying one needs to look beyond the face of this contract. I don't know whether the face of this contract, because I think they're arguing, look at the face of the contract, it's unambiguous.
I don't think the contract ever answers how much was paid. Uh-huh. Never.
Okay.
Right? If there's a gift, it's not in the contract. If there's if they paid $106,000, you couldn't say, oh, no, they didn't pay $106,000 because it's not in the contract. The gift and the payments, they're all applications to the contract. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Rebuttal.
Thank you. Just starting where Mr. Von Korff left off. Related to the dispute between whether it was a 20-year contract or a 15-year contract, I took Christy Coleman's deposition. She testified that was a drafting error by my client's prior attorney, Kelly Springer, and that she believed it was going to be 15 years because they had wanted to pay it off sooner. My clients had it written in for 20 years, and Christy Coleman, you know, in this case, never disputed that. They did not raise that as an issue at summary judgment. Of course, they wouldn't have wanted to, because that's a material fact, I think, you know, the 15
years.
So
you think it was a 15-year, and that the contract would have been, is that right?
No, what I'm saying is that the Colemans alleged that it was, in their understanding, supposed to be a 15-year period of term, and that when I deposed Ms. Coleman during the litigation, she told me that she wanted it to be 15 years because her and her husband's goal had been to try to pay it off in a shorter period of time. But she did admit to me that it wasn't written up that way. It was written up as a 20-year payment term over a 20-year period of time, and that she blamed the prior attorney for a drafting error in that regard. However, that was not brought up, of course, in respondent's motion for summary judgment before the district court, because I'm sure they didn't want to raise a fact issue about that.
But it doesn't really matter, because there's a prepayment clause also in the contract for deed.
There is, yes, and my clients do acknowledge that there is. However, what's interesting about the respondent's position related to that prepayment is, according to their math and their self-made amortization charts, the payment that they tried to tender, which my clients did reject, for the $257,012 and some odd cents, is only did not include any allocation for interest. And if you look at the terms also of the contract for deed, any prepayment would have needed to include an allocation for interest. Again, like my earlier comment, if this is a deal that you can get with a bank or with anyone, really, you know, 0% interest, that's a great deal. But that is not what my clients agreed to, and it certainly isn't what the terms of the contract would have provided for.
So you think that had a payoff, that they had to add on to that the interest as if they didn't pay it off until the end of the 20 years?
Well, not necessarily actually, they probably should have. My client testified in his deposition he expected to be paid about $750,000 on this deal.
I mean, if I paid off my mortgage, I think it's a money saver for me. I do that in order to avoid paying the rest of the interest.
Right.
You're arguing that you'd have to pay it off plus interest, even though you paid it off?
And maybe I said that wrong, and I apologize. Okay. I'm trying to get to the point that they did not make any whatsoever any allocation for interest at all, and that relates also to this claim of making, you know, this $110,000 payment related to the sale of the tractor and baler. The judge found in this case that was all going to be applied to principal and zero to interest. There was nothing in the contract that spoke to that. It did not include any type of allocation for interest. That's another issue that we felt was a material breach as well and should have allowed summary judgment to go our way instead of the other way. And then just
so I think that the argument, so maybe the math works out if one just looked at the face of the contract, I don't know, with that payment, monthly payment for 20 years, maybe that works out the math at $1.04 million, I don't know, and maybe you know. But at the end of the day, I think the rest of it is that the rest of the undisputed evidence is that they, in fact, were gifting $600,000-plus, and they actually did gift forms to that end, and that was all part of the same transaction, which effectively reduced the, and it was a gift in the form of reduction of the price to this contract. What's wrong with the result here, that that's, in fact, what it seems like the undisputed evidence called proved.
Thank you for bringing that up. That was another point I wanted to make in relation to Mr. Von Korff's comments. So those gift tax returns, because of how this deal was structured incorrectly by inflating the value of the property pursuant to the purchase agreement and the contract for deed, that cannot be considered as tender, like legal tender money. If it did, then the Colemans would have to report that on their taxes as a forgiven debt. So if you get a loan forgiven, you have to report that as additional income, and I don't believe that that has occurred here. Furthermore, those tax returns, those gift returns, were rescinded by my clients. Within 3 years, as we all know, we can file amended tax returns, and so that is actually what my clients did do. They filed amended tax returns for tax year 2018, which is when this deal was signed up, December 28th of 2018.
So I don't know about all the tax consequences and whether this was, like, okay from the start or it's okay now or what the parties need to figure out. But the question, I think, is what was owed for this property on the contract for deed? However, the tax consequences were addressed by the parties. And you're arguing, I mean, I think one of the arguments on the gift is once given, it's given and it's not revoked. Whether one files a different tax document or not, how does that revoke a gift?
Thank you. That's a great question. So I look at it as if I am planning to gift someone money for the purchase of a home, and I know respondents had quite a few cases related to, is the giving of cash a loan or was it just a gift? And I guess how I want to distinguish this is that those cases all dealt with actual money, actual cash. So one of the cases respondents cited dealt with a couple, it's from a 1961 case, I'm sorry I have it printed out here, but it dealt with a couple who was gifted over $5,000 for the purchase of a home. Later that was disputed whether that was a gift or whether that was a loan. So with that, you have actually cash money changing hands. And I don't mean to belittle the point of this, I'm not saying it very articulately and I apologize for that, but it's legal tender, shall we say. In this case, it was in the air. I mean, this is like a tax deal off to the side. It's not actual cash. It's not legal tender that was provided. And the mere fact that in one hand you can say that that is a gift applicable to forgiveness of a loan or applicable to the purchase of a farm, but then if you're able to take that back, that's not really something you can make delivery on. And that's one of the legal, you know, prongs that are required to show a gift is delivery. So if you're saying, you know, respondent's position is, well, this was gifted, it's done, it was filed, it's done as of 2018. Well, if that's really true, it really can't be because that can be unwound and undone. In those other cases that you have from the respondent's brief, that cash was gone. It was spent. It had actually been delivered as tender, applied to a purchase of a home. It was no longer there. It was spent. In this situation, we have the tax gifting, which could be taken back and it was. So I don't think we can have it both ways, would be my answer.
Presiding Judge. Mm-hmm. So I want to make sure I understand something that you just said in your rebuttal. You said that your client was expecting to be paid $700,000-some, which as I understand it then is the 523 or whatever, plus 3.5% interest over the term of the contract. Is that right?
Well, I guess maybe I said that wrong too. That was what we had in our notice of cancellation of contract for deed. And the way the procedures went with that is a little strange here because the Colemans actually sued the Gardings for specific performance. So then we had to counter and, you know, do the cancellation and farmer lender mediation notice and such. But that number is from the notice of cancellation.
So you don't know whether it's 523 plus interest or whether it's 1.04 million minus what they had already paid, which is how I had thought about it. Maybe I don't know which one it is.
we're basing this all on the four corners of the document, the $1,040,000, that, you know, over the 20 years period of time, which is how the document was actually drafted and what was signed off on by all the parties, that notice of cancellation actually relates to that $1,040,000 minus the amount that had been already paid at that time, including interest.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period. And that concludes our calendar for this morning, and we are adjourned. Thank you.
All rise.